For those who don't have an understanding of Ritchie's life, can you give us a little bit of a brief rundown of why he's important?
Sure. Well, this year is the 400th anniversary of his death. He died in Beijing on May 11, 1610, after a very wonderful time in China. He was born 2 months before Francis Xavier died in China. Xavier died on the coast of China in 1552 in December, no doubt hoping and praying that someone would be able to get in there, as he was unable to. And God was already answering his prayer, because Ricci was born in what's now Italy in October of the same year, 1552, on October 8. He was a foundation student at a Jesuit college there, went to university, joined the Jesuits on August 15, 1571, and his acting novice master at one stage was a wonderful Jesuit surnamed Valignano, who became the man in charge of the Jesuits in Asia, and he had an inspired vision of what could be done. He was responsible for activity from India to Macau to Japan, and he was instrumental in encouraging Ricci to volunteer for the East. Ricci could have settled down to a very comfortable life as a professor in Italy. He was a very gifted student and had lots of connections, but he felt the Lord calling him to the East, and he volunteered, and after a while his offer was accepted, and he got sent to India, first of all, to complete his studies for the priesthood. He was ordained in India in July of 1580, and not long afterwards was sent to Macau, which was a trading post where contact was made with China. And a couple of other Jesuits had been into China a few times but weren't allowed to stay. But one of them, Ruggieri, he mentioned the accomplishments of Ricci as regards mathematics and science and other things. Ricci had studied maths under Clavius, one of the most famous maths teachers in Europe at the time. And somehow or other they were able to go in to China.
So Ricci was able to win over a lot of people in China then?
Yes, by his interest in the culture, in the language, and his dedication to studying the language. And he made friends with all classes of society, but especially the scholarly class. Sometimes people think of him as just aiming at the scholars, the educated group, but in fact, he and his companions, when they eventually settled down in Beijing and other areas, they spent most of their time looking after ordinary people and trying to set up groups of Christians and that.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ricci also, I think, was a bit of a controversial figure in the Catholic Church at the time, and in particular, I guess, with his relationship to local culture. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those issues?
Well, Michael, the main one was over the question of what's called the Chinese rites, which means the way the Chinese respect their ancestors. Unfortunately, in English, we have the term ancestor worship, but worship is not really the correct word. It's really veneration or respect or honour. And Ricci, with his understanding of Chinese culture, was quick to realise that this veneration was no barrier to a Chinese person becoming a Christian. And he allowed for that sort of use of local custom to be part of a Chinese Christian's life, and to honour the dead, to pray for the dead, to remember them. Unfortunately, other missionaries and even Catholic missionaries and also many Protestant missionaries later on, they saw this business as in a different way, and they tried to stop it. And within the Catholic Church, it became quite a controversy, the rites controversy, and it went on for decades and even centuries. And eventually, not so long after Ricci's death in 1610, the Vatican decided to come down on the side of Ritchie's opponents, and they declared it as incompatible with Christian living. But then, hundreds of years later, in the time of Pius XII in 1939, the church finally said, ah, Ritchie had it right. And he was right about the rites. And the church said that such practice is not a barrier to for someone to become a Christian. And now in some parts of Asia, for example, in Taiwan and parts of Hong Kong, within the church building, there's a whole wall sometimes with photos of deceased parishioners. And at the time of the Chinese festivals for the dead, once or twice a year, there's a liturgy for venerating those people, and people may do that in their homes as well. So Ritchie was ahead of his time there. He also tried to incorporate local language. At one stage he had permission for Mass in Chinese, which is hundreds of years before Vatican II allowed for Mass in local language. He realised that not having the Bible in Chinese, not having a liturgy in Chinese, was a tremendous barrier to local people becoming Christians.
Ritchie himself has undergone a bit of a transformation this century in how he's seen by the broader Catholic Church. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, well, that's very true, and seems to be a trait of the Jesuits, like Teilhard de Chardin, the same thing, in and out of favour. But now Ritchie is praised. He was praised not long ago by Pope John Paul II also. Pope John Paul II said that that Ritchie established a bridge between the church, between Europe and China and Chinese culture, and a safe and solid bridge. And the Pope said we can follow Ritchie's example very safely. And I think that's very true. Ritchie was way ahead of his time there. And today, as the church tries to work out which way to go in evangelization, I think Ritchie's example is very valid. Seems to me, on the one hand, you've got a lot of Catholics, at least, who've lost the fire for evangelization, or are too shy or too scared to witness to the Lord. And on the other hand, you've got people who are, again, starting to beat the drums in a way that was done in a more triumphalistic era, and more or less not caring about people's feelings, other cultures' feelings, a more aggressive type of evangelization. I think both are both extremes are to be avoided, and Ritchie's a wonderful example of someone who stayed in the middle. He used all his tremendous talents for the goal of evangelization, but also for the goal of helping the culture grow as a culture. As the Pope said, becoming Christian enhances a culture, it doesn't take away. And Ritchie, by incorporating elements of local culture, was very good at doing that. And he'd be right against this movement now of a very aggressive style of evangelization. So he'd be in the middle, and I think he's a very good model for all times.
The Catholic Church in China at the moment is, is an interesting situation, where you have the official church and the unofficial church alongside each other. Can you talk a little bit about what the situation is there in China at the moment?
I think the best description of the situation there was made by Cardinal Echegaray in 2003, when he went to China as the representative of Pope John Paul II, and he tried to get the two sides to get together, the official and the unofficial, or the above the ground, below the ground, whatever the people like to call them. And he pointed out that there's not two churches but one church. He said there's one church with two faces. Now, because of historical reasons, the underground church is understandably, I suppose, hesitant to make friends with the official people because of all the conflict in the past and harsh treatment of underground people. And but I think they've gone too far. My understanding, they've gone too far. And their mouthpiece in the international media is the Cardinal Kung Foundation, in, based in the States. But I feel that group of people goes overboard as regards the situation in China. I compare it with a parish or a school, the situation in China. The government there wants to know what's going on, and very often when they know what's going on, they don't mind it. Just like in a church or in a parish or a school, a teacher or catechist may want to take out a group of students or children. Not a big deal, so long as they check with the secretary of the parish or the school. But if somebody takes a group out and doesn't tell anybody, it's understandable those in authority get upset. Now, it's not quite the same with the Chinese government, but there is an element there that they just want to know what's going on. And very often, so long as they know what's going on, you can do a lot. And in the official church, that there are official churches everywhere. And to some extent, it's unnecessary for the unofficial church to be running programs and masses and that secretly. It's not quite as simple as that. There's still a bit of interference and so on with the official church, but in most places, more and more places, there's not that much interference, and people are free to go to mass and visit the church and so on as they are anywhere else. So I think the mind of Cardinal Echegaray was to try to come together a bit more and stop fighting among ourselves. And this would have been Ricci's idea too, that to work together, not be divided.
Part of the church's mission in the world involves talking to governments and calling out world leaders where there are issues of poverty and injustice, particularly, I guess, in terms of people's needs, basic primary needs for food, healthcare, education, those kinds of things, but also in terms of freedom to choose, freedom to live, and freedom of life. Now, how do you strike that balance as a religious person working in China between providing these basic needs and helping people on the ground, and also then trying to kind of tackle some of these issues at a bigger level?
It's a very delicate question, a very delicate issue. At the moment, I think the church has got to remain maybe less vocal than it could be, because to be too vocal would be counterproductive and cause such a reaction that it would make things worse. I think Hong Kong sets a good example here. The Hong Kong diocese is very diplomatic and very careful. It will speak out in certain ways at times, but it does so, what would you say, very carefully or prudently. Prudent witness, maybe the word prudence is a key word there. And Ricci was like that too. He would stand up for people's rights, but he did it in such a way that he didn't make things worse. So this is the trick, how to stand up for people's rights without making things worse. At the moment, it's not easy there, not easy. It's a very complicated situation.
That whole relationship between China and the rest of the world is going to be one that's going to dominate global politics for the next 100 years at least. What does Ricci's example, what does Ricci have to teach us about how to go about maintaining and building this relationship?
Well, first of all, I think his example of learning the language and studying the culture, that's a very good example, and give him his due, Kevin Rudd has followed that example in learning Mandarin and setting up a Chinese research centre, I think, and encouraging the use of Chinese in schools. I think that sort of thing is very, very good, because without language and understanding of culture, communication is much more difficult. Ricci also would remind us that the Chinese by nature are a peaceful people. They're not aggressive. In one of his writings, he mentioned how he thought the people in Europe were very politically aggressive and greedy, and the countries there were always at war and trying to grow bigger and dominate other countries and groups, whereas in China which was a much bigger setup than Europe, more people and so on, there wasn't that sort of conflict. Ritchie said China and its leaders were not aggressive. They just wanted to get on with life, and they weren't trying to take over other countries or other groups. And I think that basic trait is still there. We should be very slow to see China as an aggressive power. I think that's a mistake. There's probably people there in the military and so on, or some extreme groups, as there are in any country, who'd like to be aggressive and so on. But I think Ricci would say to us that the majority of Chinese people, and please God, the majority of Chinese leaders, are very much peaceful people. And if we treat them with respect and so on, we'll do more for peace in Asia and peace in the world than if we were to see them as rivals and foes and so on.
Well, thanks very much, John.
Thank you, Michael.